Okay, so church history. Quickly, where we've been. We've gotten to trace the arc a little bit of church history and power and state and church power. We saw the church under persecution. We saw Constantine come up, and Constantine offer relief, but also kind of blend that church-state boundary. Then we saw someone like Leo. Leo, who was primarily a churchman, but who also got state function. Not because he was power hungry, but because people needed him, right? The people were under attack. We saw Stephen II, who then went and got the Franks and had them help out. Once again, the Italian people were under attack. That it wasn't the church just looking to become a nation state. She wasn't looking to have her own army. She wasn't looking to have her own land mass. It was the result of a state that was so desperate because it had been riddled by wars and by these marauding groups of tribes for centuries that this became the solution. Okay, so as we get where we're going now, we're about to look at the church at one of her darker periods. Okay, what can happen is you can begin to get a caricature of the church, right? Like this is what she is. This is what, when you have like Roman Catholicism or whatever, this is the Pope, and this is no. It grew up organically, right? And almost everything, as bad as it gets, everything began with really good motives, right? People trying to have a pure church, trying to have a well-governed church. It just got astray. So, we talked last time about Pepin. Remember, Pepin is the one who donated the northern Italian states. For those that weren't here last time, we are now up into the 8th century. And what has happened is you have a group just over the Alps called the Lombards. And they keep coming down into Italy, over the Alps, and raiding especially northern Italy. And so Pope goes and he gets help by the Franks. And the Frankish king at the time is a guy by the name of Pepin. Pepin comes in, he helps out, he beats off the Lombards. He doesn't completely wipe them out, but he at least establishes peace in the northern part of Italy. And then he gives all those northern states, that northern territory, to the church in what's called the Donation of Pepin. And then he also says, if you need an army, I will help you raise one. So at the point where we got to last week, you have a church state that has people that, you know, people live in these states and they pay taxes and they have requirements. And the church now has to administer all of that. And they've got an army, and they've got land. So they're much more of a nation now than the typical church institution that we're used to. Well, Pepin has a son, and his son is named Charlemagne. Right? Raise your hand if you've heard of Charlemagne. Yeah. He tends to be a pretty big guy. Pope Adrian I enlists the help of Charlemagne because the Lombards begin to come back over the Alps, back into Italy. Charlemagne does what Pepin did not, and he actually just wipes the Lombards away. I mean, he pretty much defeats them to the point where they never become an issue again. In return, the Pope, Adrian I, for those of you that would like to know, declares Charlemagne the Emperor of the Romans. Okay? And thus starts the Holy Roman Empire. When you think of the Holy Roman Empire, I think most of us tend to think of just the same thing as the Roman Empire, right? It just got holy at some point, right? This is the beginning of the Holy Roman Empire. A pope hadn't really coronated an emperor until now. Pepin had gotten bestowed upon him a title as well. One of the issues, though, is that as the pope goes to crown Charlemagne, and this is a ceremony where Charlemagne is supposed to bend down and the Pope is supposed to literally crown him the emperor, as he's doing this motion, he takes the crown out of the Pope's hand and crowns himself. Right? And it's a not so subtle way of saying, you don't make me who I am, I make me who I am. Right? You've now got what has been kind of bubbling under the surface, starting to break out a little bit. who has ultimate authority? Does the church make somebody king and emperor, or does that king and emperor make himself, by his own authority, by his state authority, make himself king and emperor? Well, Charlemagne does a number of things. One of the things that he does during his reign is that he starts a university system. Our oldest universities. The oldest university that we have is the University of Bologna in Italy. Was started in, I want to say the 11th century. But we're formed after these universities that Charlemagne creates, and he creates them wherever there's a bishopric, right? Wherever there's a large church, which happened to be in a large city center somewhere, he would then create a school, right? And this becomes your first university system. Called universities, by the way, because they have a universal worldview, right? Everything that you learn plugs into one universal idea, which is God, which is theology. Theology reigned over all of them, right? Someone recently said we no longer have universities because everything's siloed, right? You go to the biology department, you go to the chemistry department, you go to the philosophy department, whatever. We should instead have multiversities, right, instead of universities, because you don't learn anything unified when you come out the other side. Anyways, he starts what's called the Carolingian Renaissance by creating these schools and universities. This also completes the break from a state standpoint between East and West, right? We've been seeing the kind of conflict between East and West, and that's driven a lot of what's gone on. Now you have the West in a position where she has an empire, or she has an emperor, and she has defined boundaries, and she no longer pays tribute to the East at all, and feels like she's on equal footing with the East. Does that make sense? And before, we had had some kings that had come in, some people who had taken the throne, especially in the 5th century. But the East had a bigger military and would come in and would actually topple those people as part of the 20-year war that we talked about last week. Now you've got to the point where the West is the West again. It's its own empire, and it's on equal footing with the East. This doesn't last too long, though. What happens is that Charlemagne dies. And it's often the case in history, I think we've talked about this before, you have a really good charismatic leader. Yeah, we talked about it with Attila. You have a good charismatic leader, and it's supposed to go to the son, and the son just can't handle the weight that the father did. He just doesn't live up to the same ability. Charlemagne is actually one of the examples that breaks that rule. Pepin was a good leader. Charlemagne actually dwarfs him, but then his sons don't ever come up. And then the land that he had ends up being parceled out to his grandchildren, and then his grandchildren end up fighting one another over the land. So you end up with what is sometimes called the Dark Age of the Papacy right here. It's interesting to see who calls this the Dark Age of the Papacy. Well, in just a second, we'll talk about another place that some people call the Dark Age of the Church. People will call this the Dark Age of the Papacy because this should have been a place where the papacy could have stepped in. You're going to have 150 years or so where you don't have much organization, where you've got a lot of infighting. And if you had had a charismatic strong leader like Leo, like Gregory, then easily could have taken power and advanced the papal position, advanced their position that we're kind of the authority that you go to. We're the one who kings kings and makes emperors. We're the ones you put your faith in. Instead, the popes end up becoming pawns largely of the Franks and of land barons, and they get brought down into these squabbles. We talked about it last time. You can even see this in some of their titles. Before, when we talked about Gregory and we talked about Leo, their titles were the Great. There are only three greats, by the way, in church history, Gregory and Leo being two of them. So you move from titles, from the people themselves. These titles are usually given by the church and the laity. So you get some sense what the church thought about these people in their titles. So you go from the great, the pious, the prayerful, those sort of titles, to the fat, the bald, the stammerer, right? You've got a series of titles that show you, very passive-aggressive, that the church itself and the people really had no faith in this group of leaders that came out after them. So what happens then is you have 150 years or so where there's largely infighting and there's no organization until a guy comes along by the name of Otto. Anyone ever heard of Otto before? Yeah, I'd be surprised if you had. Otto is a German, surprise, surprise. All those groups from Germany that we saw across, they go everywhere. And he brings peace to the region in 962. So now we're all the way up to the 10th century. I mean, we couldn't get out of the 4th century for the first 5 weeks, right? And here we are, week 7, we're all the way up in the 10th. He brings peace. He conquered northern Italy. Northern Italy becomes kind of the hotbed of chaos and fighting at the time. The papal states themselves are fighting. The popes are, they're bought in by different families who then also have different land allegiances. So he comes in and he kind of settles all of that, and he brings peace for the first time. And so that pope who was reigning at the time, Pope John the 12th, crowns Otto the Holy Roman Emperor. Otto sees something that if any other king has seen it or any other emperor has seen it, he certainly hasn't been able to do it as well. Otto recognizes the power in the individual bishoprics. Okay? You have to understand a little bit about what's going on here. By this point, bishoprics, if you're a bishop, it is a successful, wealthy place to be. These, keep in mind, when we talked about monks and all that, people who reject things, asceticism, that was largely the East who did that. The West really hadn't gone to that position yet. And the bishops lived good, wealthy lifestyles. They also had a lot of influence over local towns. In the American West, if you wanted a town, if you wanted to create a town, you needed the railway, right? The railroad needed to stop in your town if you wanted to become a boom town. If you wanted to become a town in medieval Europe, you needed the bishop's approval, because the bishop decided where the churches were. Wherever the churches were was where towns grew up. If you were a person in the medieval ages, two of the three largest pieces of technology, the most cutting-edge pieces of technology that you were ever going to see in your entire life, you found at church: the pipe organ and the clock. Okay? So wherever there were churches, people gathered and towns grew up. They had a lot of political power. And Otto recognized it. And so Otto said, if I can put my people in these bishoprics, I can have kind of co-regents everywhere. Right? Not only is there power through the imperial line, there's power through the church line. And so Otto begins buying bishoprics. This is an act called simony. Right? It's named after Simon Magus in the Bible, who tries to buy from the apostles the ability to have the Holy Spirit. That's where it comes from. Simony, from this point forward, will be a huge issue all the way up to and including the Reformation. Okay? You will have people at all levels who will buy their way into office, including the Pope himself. And we'll look at one person who does that specifically here in just a few minutes. This sets up a bit of a fight between the Pope and the Emperor Otto. The technical term is investiture. Okay, that's the investiture controversy. Who is it that gets to decide who the bishops are? Now, it had always been, in theory, the church who had decided who the bishops were. But in practice, and it had been going this way for centuries, it was either local land barons or local populations that decided who their bishop was. And that made sense. Even when the Pope is crowned, He is crowned because the people at Rome elect him the Roman bishop, right? The people who do this. Later, and again, we'll see in just a second, when that begins to get corrupt, the church says, okay, we need to take that process out of the people's hands. They don't need to have any investiture ability whatsoever, right? And then you end up with this fight between, does the king have the right to assign them? Do land barons have the right to assign them? Or is it the church that has the right to assign them? The church is always trying to grab this back, to grab this right back, because she sees early that as long as she can't appoint her own leaders, she can't be a pure church. Think about it for just a minute. If in our presbytery, all of our ministers were appointed by the Obama administration, right? Whatever you think of Obama's administration, if they were appointed by Obama's administration, what would church be like for us right now? I would dare say it would be drastically different than it is now, right? And the church realizes that as long as it is political power, it is state power that is driving the people who are put into position, she is never going to be able to be a pure church. She's never going to be able to actually affect doctrine. And there are always people who are pious Christians inside the church. Always. And they always want to affect good change for the church. Right? So this becomes a hotbed issue for the church and for the state over the next few centuries. Now, I've alluded to it a couple of times. The church becomes highly influenced by the state, even all the way up to the Pope himself. You can go back and you can look through this era of church history, and you can actually find a number of popes that you look at them and you go, okay, I wouldn't expect that from a pope, right? But we're going to look at one specifically because he kind of typifies. Now, again, I want to be careful here. This does not mean that every pope that ever reigned was, you know, terrible or degenerate, or you won't see him in glory, right? But there's a period here where the papacy gets pretty corrupt. It is typified by Benedict the Ninth. Benedict the Ninth becomes the pope for the first time in 1032. He becomes pope because, like I said, the pope, being the bishop of Rome, is an elected position. And so his father buys off the election. By everything we can tell, he buys off the election and gets his son elected pope. His son reigns as pope for 12 years the first time. There's a book called The Oxford Dictionary of Popes. It's actually written by a guy who is Anglican, J.N.D. Kelly. But it tends to be very even-handed. Most people who are Catholic will say this is a pretty even-handed, just reference book about the popes. Who they were, when they reigned, kind of what their policies were. If you're interested in popes, pick that up. That's kind of your primary reference. He says there that it is hard to see Benedict the Ninth as anything other than highly unethical, even accounting for any propaganda of the age. Because there were multiple reports, independent reports, of rape, of murder, and of torture, all of which perpetrated by the Pope himself. Right? After 12 years in the office, he is run out by the people. The people actually oust him. It's a coup from Rome. And they get him out of the church. This lasts about a year and a half, where you have some fighting about who is it that will be the Bishop of Rome. And once both sides kind of diminish in their power because they've been fighting, he comes back and gets the papacy again. So this is the second time in office, right? He's the only one with the distinction, Benedict the Ninth, the only one with the distinction to have had the papacy three times in his own life. So he gets it again. That time he only keeps the papacy for 2 months, and then he sells it to his uncle. Right? Then, about another year and a half later or so...
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
When they're, like, selling the papacy to various people,
yes.
You mentioned that there were always they let this happen?
Yeah.
I don't understand how they were able to have any authority.
It's a good question for those that might be listening. Again, hi, Mom. The question is, if there are pious people in the church, how is it that they are allowing church leaders, bishops, and the Pope to be the office to be bought and sold, right? And the problem is that just like today, where you have you may have pious people in a particular region, right? And we'll take religion out of it. People who genuinely care about upholding things like justice, right? And yet there are still going to be offices like a constable, a sheriff, or whatever, that can be bought and sold, where you don't have the ability as a pious person to even speak in or do anything against someone being in and placed in that position, right? So if the people who have authority at the time, the infrastructure of Rome, if they're bought off, like what seems to happen here with Benedict the Ninth, father is a land baron, has money, buys off the rest of the land barons, has his son elected, there's very little that the lay people can do to keep that from happening. They just don't have the power or the ability. Does that make sense?
Are there records of any of them speaking up throughout this time?
That's a good question. There are records of accusations against the Pope himself as he moves through this 12-year period. So there are records of accusations of rape, murder, and torture. What if there are records of anybody rallying or sermonizing against him at some point? I'm not real sure. I would imagine there would have to be some in order for that coup to have affected to get him out the very first time, right? Who organized it, how it got organized, why it took 12 years, I'm not sure. I can try and look it up and maybe get back to you on that. But good question. Good question. Any other questions? Okay, so he sells it to his uncle. About a year and a half later, he gets elected yet again as Pope. It's because, like, his uncle's not a good Pope. They realize there's questions about anti-Popes, real Popes. Because you got to keep in mind, like, if you look, there are almost always anti-Popes along with real Popes. People who say, I'm the Pope, but the church never really acknowledges that they're the Pope. So you can go and look. You have your own list of anti-popes. So there are like popes, anti-popes. No one's real sure. Well, we know this guy was pope at one point, right? So at least we bring him back, and he brings some stability. They bring him back, and then later he was excommunicated, right? Now, keep in mind, it's one thing to be excommunicated by the East, right? Because East and West will take jabs at each other back and forth, right? It's another thing to be the Pope and be impeached by your own church, right? To be excommunicated by your own church. That, it just tells you the level that we are at when we talk about corruption in the church at this point. The reason that's important is because now we're about to get to, and we'll talk about for the next week or two, the very first efforts at reform. The church tries to reform herself, right? The Reformation does not happen. It's not like the Reformation goes, you know what? We're just tired of this and we're going to split. You know, we're done, right? We Presbyterians, we can be kind of guilty of that sometimes. You don't like this and I don't like that and that's it. We'll just go start our own churches, our own denominations. The church tried to reform herself. She tried to reform herself back then and it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work, and this will be the critique, the reason it didn't work is because it didn't go back to Scripture, right? It continued to look back to tradition to reform herself rather than going all the way back to the truth, the foundation, Scripture itself, okay? And everyone says, except for those maybe that are in power and are benefiting from the corruption, this is corrupt. Again, those titles, those names, they tell you something, right? The stammerer, the child, the bald. Right? People realize there's a problem here, and we need to do something about it. Okay, so a couple of things happen for reform. We'll talk about papal reform next week, and that'll actually lead into Gregory or Hildebrand and Henry. Great group of lectures. Bring popcorn. it's just one of those things like, really? He said that? That's awesome. But a couple of ways that the church tried to reform itself before we get there. The monks, by the way, at this point, because they are getting their monasteries because of landed wealth, because of land barons. Those land barons are recognizing that there is power in the church, right? Otto has set that up. He's shown kind of a paradigm for a way for you to get power, not only political power, but power through the church. And so what a lot of these politico land barons are doing is they're offering a little bit of land for a monastery, but they want to put their abbot in charge. They give these monks everything, food, wine, whatever they want. And if one of these monks happens to come up into a position of power, because that was one of the major pathways, right? This monk is going to be, his allegiance is going to be to you, right? So it was a bet. It was a, if I have a couple of these monasteries and I keep them well stocked and well fed and get these guys to the point where they are, their allegiance is to me, and one of them ends up being one of the head administrators for the Pope, guess what? My stock rises. Does that make sense? Right? So even the monasteries are largely, at this point, a source of corruption. One of the biggest pieces of communication, one of the most common pieces of communications that we have by this point. Remember, back in the 5th century, we said you could drop a monastery somewhere, and they're like the paratroopers. They converted people, right? As much, whatever you believe about monastery life, and I'm not for monastery life, right? They really did have a good evangelical effect on the people around them. Now what we see is people saying, get these drunkards out of town. They come in here, they drink, they don't work, right? And then they just lay around on the streets. Can you please move these monasteries further away from the city, right? Those are the sort of communications that you're getting from townsfolk to the church. They'd gotten away from those Benedictine rules of communal worship, manual labor, and meditative study. So you end up with two ways to reform it. You got an internal reform, a place called Cluny, the Cluny Reform. They decided, you know what, if we're going to reform, we don't have any landed wealth. If you give us a piece of land that is our land, we have no allegiance to you who gave it to us, right? And there's a guy, he is William the Pious, who starts this. He's a French duke. He's the first one to give land. And not only do they pick up the Benedictine rule, those three, man, they pick up asceticism. They're the ones who, for the very first time, say, you can't even talk, right? You know the monks, you hear about monks that don't even talk during the day? They're only allowed to talk during like one period of the day for like 15 minutes? This is where that gets instituted, right here, right? Because the church is so corrupt, right? You just look and you see the corruption, and you've got these waves of pious people who want to find a way to reform the church, right? When were we pious? When were we doing something positive for Christ? Well, look back to when the monasteries were actually doing the job. Well, let's try and get there and up at one. You know, monastery plus one. Yes. Right? And that's what the Clunys become. The Clunys, for the next 700 years, stay free of any sort of outside influence. The only people they report to is the Pope, and they only report to the Pope in spiritual matters. They refuse to allow the Pope to appoint abbots. They refuse to allow the Pope to appoint leaders whatsoever. Okay, last thing, because I've already kept you over. The friars. This is when the friars come up as well. The friars decide, well, we don't need landed wealth either, because again, landed wealth leads to corruption. So what we're going to do is we're going to come up through the educational system, through those universities. We're going to learn how to preach the gospel. We're going to learn how to give the mass, but we're going to be wanderers. Right? So, you know, Friar Tuck, right? Because that's how everybody knows the friars, Friar Tuck, from Robin Hood, right? He is someone who goes around to different places and gives mass and just relies on people giving him money for his work. He doesn't have a home church. He doesn't have a home monastery, right? And they say, we refuse to have anything that has a home like that, because once you begin to get planted there, you get under the influence of either the land barons, right, the Pope himself, or the monastery system. And we're not going to do that. That sets up, by the way, a critique between the friars and the monks and then the clergy that you will see all the way for the next 500 years. When the Reformation happens, a lot of their critique isn't something new. They're just picking up the critiques from the friars and the monks and the clergy system. And they're just saying, they're right. And now we've got to get back to Scripture to fix it. Okay? Questions? All right. Mind if I close this in prayer?